Welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhellman. Continuing our conversation on land use adaptation that is taking place to answer the call for more climate action, I wanted to shift the focus of today's episode back to food production, back to agriculture and its impact, both good and bad, on nature. According to a study published earlier this year in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, more than a third of farmland in the U.S. Corn Belt, nearly 100 million acres, has completely lost its carbon-rich topsoil due to erosion. The loss of topsoil has reduced corn and soybean yields in the Midwest by 6%, resulting in a loss of nearly $3 billion a year for farmers and increased runoff and sediment and nutrients into nearby waterways, which is worsening water quality. The study, led by scientists at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, found that the greatest loss of carbon-rich topsoil was tied to tillage, which is the repeated plowing of fields that negatively disrupts and dislodges soils. And this thus begins the erosion down slopes and eventually downriver. Harkening back to lessons learned nearly a century ago, where the worst human-made natural disaster took place, thanks mostly to similar extractive and short-sighted mindsets in land management, I ask the question, are we queuing ourselves up for another Dust Bowl? But this time at a global rather than just a regional scale. To get some clarity on the role of agriculture and how it will play out in the future in land use adaptation to fight climate change, a friend, a confidant, and a mentor who is nice enough to join me from the U.S. Breadbasket, Fred Kirschemann. Hey, Fred, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, thanks for taking the time. First question I have for you. So we've lost a third, as mentioned, in the breadbasket, and we're still predominantly hooked on the same input-based extractive approach to producing our grains that got us in this precarious spot in the first place. So, Fred, you spent your career, it's your life's work, focused on this thin living skin that surrounds the planet and keeps all biodiversity alive. What's being done now in Iowa and throughout the U.S. to evolve these land practices to preserve existing topsoil?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And the good news, I think, and it's not a lot of good news yet, but there's at least there are the early beginnings of some recognitions by the farmers themselves that they need to make some changes. Driven partly by the fact that the current intensive input system of agriculture is increasingly becoming economically unviable. And so they know they need to make some changes. And even the Iowa Farmers Union, which is one of our more traditional farm organizations, they've begun to recognize this, and they now have a regular weekly lunch and learn program where they feature some of the farmers who have made these changes. And the basic changes which they've made is that instead of monoculture intensive input systems, they've now moved to more diverse systems that are more self-renewing and self-regulating. And like I say, it's still a small percentage of the overall farmers because I don't mean this critical of the farmers that aren't making these changes, because, you know, for almost 100 years now, we have been telling farmers that if they're going to be successful, they have to get big or get out, and they have to, you know, farm fence row to fence row. And so that's what they've done. And the average age of our farmers now is, I think, in the high 70s, as I recall. So, you know, if you've devoted your whole life to a way of doing things that you've been convinced is the only way to be successful, once you get to be in your 70s, you're not too likely to be excited about making major changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other part of it, too, is how often, or else I'll ask it this way, how often do farmers feel like the finger is being wagged at them, that they are the problem rather than the solution? You know, I think Eisenhower famously said you can't push a plow with a pen, but ultimately a lot of people making these decisions of how we're going to produce food and telling farmers how to do it have no experience in that space. How do producers balance all of that and still, you know, do their day-to-day, of which is a 20-hour day to begin with, never mind instituting this new operating model.
Yeah, well, what you've just described is a culture shift. And as we all know, I think that culture shifts generally, you know, don't happen overnight. They evolve over time. And, you know, there, I think part of the, again, part of the good news is that there are an increasing number of people who are addressing these issues in their writings, et cetera, that are also contributing to at least the early beginnings of this kind of culture shift. And, you know, one of those that really impressed me was E.O. Wilson's recent book, which he published, I think, 2 years ago, called Half Earth. And what he pointed out was that if we want the planet to continue to be a livable planet for us humans, then we have to keep half of it in wildness, because it's the wildness that has the self-renewing capacity that we're going to need to continue to have the kind of planet to live on that's going to work for us as humans. You know, again, if we're going to keep half the Earth in wildness, then we have to make major changes, as he pointed out in his book, even in the way in which we do agriculture, because we can't continue to keep, you know, half of the Earth, you know, in these input-dependent systems, because those input-dependent systems are not going to continue to be functional, because we aren't going to have the kind of Earth that renews them. And so increasingly, we're going to have to come to terms with that and change the way in which we eat and the way in which we live on planet Earth so that it does become self-renewing again.
Yeah, there seem to be many lessons we can pull out of nature and how we're going to feed ourselves moving forward. So taking those methodologies and that renewing process. Could you maybe take us back to a, you know, course load 101 and explain for the audience what we really mean when we talk about regenerative agricultural practices and learning from nature for growing our food in the future?
Yeah, of course, we have a long history on that. And, you know, I don't always have all the dates directly in my brain, but, you know, there were people that understood early on that the way in which we were moving in agriculture, which was, you know, that nature had to produce what we wanted her to produce, and all we had to do was to be a little bit more aggressive. And that we really needed to do is to change our perspective to learn from nature. And, you know, there were people, you know, especially back in the 1930s, you know, who took that perspective and featured in their writings how we needed to move in that direction now. But of course, there were very few farmers that really paid much attention to that. And that's not a criticism. It's understandable, because they were all told that what they needed to do was to get bigger, get out, and farm fence row to fence row. So that's what they did. It's now at a point where it's increasingly going to become dysfunctional, especially as climate change also comes into the picture now. And then also, as we know, that a lot of the natural resources that we have used to do the kind of agriculture that we've been doing are in a state of depletion. All of the inputs that we've been using to substitute for the self-renewing capacity of nature, those inputs now are in a state of depletion. You know, a good example of that is for at least the last 60 or 70 years now, the inputs have been the N, P, and K, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash. Those, all of those resources are not renewable, and so we're at a point now where some of those resources are in a state of depletion. Certainly within the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to have to make a major shift in the way in which we produce our food. Now, I think part of the good news is that many of the younger farmers, I shouldn't say many, but a growing number of younger farmers recognize this, and it's their future that they're going to have to deal with. And so they're beginning to move in this more regenerative kind of system. And, you know, it's not a big revolution yet, but it's an important one. And given their age, they are going to make a major contribution in the years ahead.
Yeah, I think we need T-shirts printed with like Rodale's famous quote there, that concise description of regenerative being everything is renewed in the process of using it, which I know you drop all the time, and I think it's such a clean and concise way of describing this. It just makes sense. I mean, that's how nature works, right? We have very minimal things in these closed loop systems that get kicked off as ecological dander. Everything else is renewed for an energy source in this nutrient cycling program. And effectively, this is an empowerment message for us humans to be part of that system again and not forcibly control it. Is my understanding correct in that?
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, you know, it's understandable that some of these individuals who already understood, 70, 80 years ago that the direction we were going in was the wrong direction. But, in terms of the kind of culture that we had developed in agriculture, you had to get bigger, get out, and you had to produce your one thing, whether that was corn and soybeans or, wherever you were, and you relied on those cheap inputs to be successful in your production. And so that's quite naturally what you did. But that input system, as I said, is going to come to a close and is to some extent already beginning to come to a close. And again, part of the good news is there are some farmers who have begun to recognize that they need to shift from an input intensive system to a regenerative or self-renewing system. Gabe Brown in North Dakota is one of those kinds of farmers. You know, his farm is just 70 miles west of my farm in North Dakota, so I've known Gabe for quite some time. But he has now developed a system on his own farm where he has the kind of diversity that pretty much everything is self-renewing. My understanding now is that, his way of doing things and the success that he's had with that has now become so successful that he is in such demand to do speaking engagement by other farmers that he told me once that if it wasn't that his son was farming with him, he would have to quit farming because he no longer has the time to spend on his own farm given the demands on his time. So again, it's, there are the early beginnings of this kind of cultural revolution that's going to determine the future of food and agriculture.
Yeah, he's a rock star in the space, right? I mean, he shares the message. He is able to concisely explain it to folks. And I think what he's done extremely well is defining it as the five principles of regenerative, right? The no disturbance, no till, no synthetics, bolstering soil's natural defense, which is that outer layer protection, almost like an armor all, as he's described it, investing in biodiversity, the living root in the ground, which is always keeping, cover crops and seasonal diversity, and then using animals at the kind of the an insect integration so that we use other species, other beings to be part of this living soil. But related to that, Fred, it seems like a lot. Wow, you step back and say, oh my gosh, it is a new operating system. It is understanding how nature works, but compared to contemporary conventional models, which is just kind of a push and play, put these inputs, it's different. Is it a complete flipping of the switch? I mean, can these desired soil health revolution, can the revolution grow out of an evolution in land management practice? Can it be one step at a time, or do we have to completely jump ship and change things so drastically to move forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know that any of us you know, have a specific answer to that. But there are, as I indicate, there are a growing number of literature now of writers that are beginning to move in this direction and pointing out that this really is the future. And one of those is, you know, David Montgomery published this book entitled Growing a Revolution, Building Our Soil Back to Life. And he features 8 farmers that he spent time on each of their farms getting the information, you know, to produce this this book. And Gabe Brown is one of those farmers. He makes a case based on this study of his that the self-renewing capacity of life in the soil, that's the foundation of a regenerative agriculture. And by regenerative, meaning self-renewing, so that you don't need all of the inputs out from outside. What you do is restore the life of the soil, which makes it self-renewing. And so the fact that there have been some studies, you know, based on what some farmers have already begun to do, is, I think, encouraging. The real challenge, I think, is going to be, again, because we have developed this culture of agriculture, of, you know, get bigger, get out, and farm fence row to fence row, and farmers have devoted their whole lives to that kind of agriculture, and getting bigger was part of the objective, then you can't expect them to suddenly, you know, change. But what we have to do is take a look at the, you know, the new generation of farmers. And one of the things, again, that's encouraging to me is that there are a growing number of these younger farmers who realize that they can't continue to do this kind of input-intensive agriculture for the rest of their lives. And so they've already begun to make those kinds of changes in their own operations. I think that one of the things that we need to think about in our culture of agriculture is how we can, like even USDA, how they can support this kind of new evolution that's already beginning to take place.
And the type of support would be from knowledge share, financial backing. How would the USDA be best served providing this for young farmers?
As we all know, in our current food and agriculture system, we expect farmers simply to be the raw material suppliers of the things that they produce. So they're not the ones that are recognized as being important to support, because they're just the raw material suppliers. And the financial support generally in this food system takes place, you know, beyond the farmers. So we have to begin to recognize that if we want this next generation of farmers to become more prominent in our food system, then we have to make sure that they get rewarded for the kinds of transformations that they're making, so that they and their children, you know, can continue to do that kind of agriculture in the future.
You had mentioned it being a cultural awakening for farmers, but is this also an opportunity to empower consumers and citizens to use this as a cultural awakening for themselves, where soil health is directly tied to the food that we consume? So 3 times daily, I'm empowered as an eater to vote for the planet and for soil health by what I choose to consume. Are you seeing trends in that direction? Are you seeing the similar type, you know, cultural awakening for the end user to actually make soil health blow up, to go mainstream?
Yeah, actually, that's exactly correct. And again, you know, I think part of the good news is that those, especially the younger farmers who have made this transition and are demonstrating that is actually, and there are also some organizations that have begun to move in that kind of direction. And there are a growing number of farmers that become engaged in that kind of system. So again, big challenge is going to be whether we make this culture change, this culture shift, sufficiently in terms of volume and timing to be able to have not only a sustainable food system, but a livable planet, for humans. And I realize these kinds of culture shifts are major shifts. But I also think that as we begin to increasingly recognize that this kind of culture that we've evolved for the last century or more, in which we think we are, as one of the quotes, we're the masters and possessors of nature, and that we can make nature do our will, that was the ultimately wrong direction for any kind of long-term success for the way humans live on the planet. So this is the kind of spiritual transformation that I think we need to continue to cultivate.
I totally agree. I mean, it's evident even in some of the more macro discussions like COP26, that food and ag was a minimal, thread of discussion there. The soil health was basically injected after the fact. It was really around reducing our footprint from emissions and waste, and instead of looking at how to engage nature for these regenerative best practices. And just to reiterate here the benefits of good soil health and regenerative land management practice, we're talking about perpetual food production, literally perpetual energy production from our soils, carbon banking and planetary stability. There'll be no chemical or synthetic runoff with using these better methodologies, those five principles of regenerative. We have cleaner, healthier living environments for all stakeholders involved that enhances nature and improves biodiversity. And our sweet water, our drinking water, it stores it. So it's like a sponge, and it clarifies and gives us basically use of other regenerative natural resources. The magic of soil health. And so much of this comes down to, again, land management practices, which is definitely more of a general bucket as a whole. But agriculture, I think, brings it kind of full circle here, where we can connect to something again. We're empowered three times a daily to be involved in that. But on that point, on the COP26, Fred, how do we get this citizens awakening and kind of like cultural shift that you had mentioned into the environmental movement around soil health? Because that should have been, bullet point number one or two at COP26, and not an afterthought. I'll put it as a provocative statement. When will that happen, and how do we go about doing that?
Yeah, another great question. And I've learned a long time ago that predicting the future is a pretty risky task. So I'm not sure that I can predict the future to answer your question. But I do think that the kinds of changes that I've been describing, which aren't just my view, the view of an increasing number of people and who are now writing about food and agriculture issues, I think we need to begin paying attention in various places in the country where some of these kinds of transitions are already taking place. And one of those is actually in New York. There is an organization that was started actually by the Rockefeller family, currently called Blue Hill Restaurant, and then a farming operation that supplies the food for that restaurant. They have begun, Jack Elger, who's the farm manager, and the chef who manages the restaurant, they have worked together for about 20 years now. And one of the things that the chef has recognized is that when he gets the food for the restaurant from soil that has been grown on soil managed by Jack, which is done in a way that the soil becomes self-renewing, then the quality of the taste of the food begins to be exactly what he's looking for. And so that whole operation outside of New York has now become really quite successful. And they're already making plans for expanding their operations into the future. And the other thing that's encouraging from my point of view is there are now 48 states in the United States that have adopted that system in small operations, and 60 other countries that have adopted that. So there is a recognition that when you work with nature and cooperate with nature in a way that restores the self-renewing capacity of the soil in nature, then that's part of the foundation of the food revolution that we need, not only because it's the way to grow food, but it's the way to have some of the best tasting food. And also it has the kind of food that has positive health implications for our human health. So again, there are some things already happening out there that I think are some kind of models. And the fact that there are other operators in other states and other countries that are recognizing that and adopting that in their own operations. And again, it's a small percentage of the overall food and agriculture system still, but as the input-intensive system continues to become unviable because the input costs are going to increase because all of those inputs that we're using, as I think I mentioned earlier, are not self-renewing. And so eventually they're going to become depleted. You know, phosphorus being a good example of that, according to studies that have been done, there are now only 4 countries that still have rock phosphate reserves from which we make our phosphorus. And at the rate that we're using up the phosphate reserves, they're projecting that at the best, we only have rock phosphate reserves for another 20 years. And as we all know, farmers are already starting to experience the increase of phosphorus costs and wondering how they can adapt to that. And one of the things that I have seen, even just in the current projections here in Iowa, where, you know, conventional operations of corn and soybeans are part of the traditional agriculture here. And corn has been always the predominant crop, soybean kind of a secondary. But because soybeans don't require the amount of phosphorus that corn does, and soybeans have some of that self-renewing capacity that farmers are projecting they're going to significantly increase their soybean production in 2022 and decrease their corn production. Simply based on costs.
Let's explore a little bit more, because I think this is a misnomer around regenerative, is just the expense, or, you know, where that ties into market. And, you know, a little side note, quite interesting, right? Because for all of our Congress folks that are listening here, we look at energy independence as being a national security concern. To Fred's point, boy, NPK is one of those examples of if we don't have those inputs and we're still stuck on that system, there's a lot of control that certain countries have over us. So maybe we should look at things differently about even what regenerative brings to the table. But Fred, let's talk here about, you mentioned your work and your involvement with Stone Barns. It's truly an epicenter. It's like a golfer going to Augusta National, or, you know, kid going to Disneyland. You show up at this place and it is something special. It is unique, and what Jack and Dan have all done to really instigate this closed loop system of what could be, what can be. It's early adopter stage, no doubt, but really it creates beacons of hope. It creates capacity to share that this is realistic. It's a real opportunity. But on the financial side of that, I think the knock that may come out of that is, well, not everybody has Rockefeller money, right? And who can afford this? And this type of model is only for the elite. But again, isn't that a misnomer? I mean, really, we're talking about regenerative being the model that is more viable and economically feasible for producers. We're talking about it for healthy, nutrient-dense, high-quality food that's good for you and the planet, and you break that down, and really, it's not that much more expensive. So could you share with our audience a bit more of the, you know, getting under the hood here of why the economics really do matter and do make sense for regenerative?
Yeah, it's a critical factor, and especially because, you know, we've got this culture transformation that has to take place, and those are always difficult. And so it is going to be, I think, primarily the economic drivers that increase the importance of the transition that we need to make to these new systems. And, you know, there's, you know, you can see this in other kinds of operations as well, like, you know, the Nyman Ranch groups there, you know, they're continuing to grow primarily, again, as I understand it, at least on economic basis. Nyman Ranch is based on the notion basically of cooperating with nature rather than controlling nature. There are, my understanding at least, is there are an increasing number of young farmers that are moving into, you know, that becoming a part of that movement. So the things which I described are also driven primarily by economics, where, you know, especially younger farmers, and again, in terms of my understanding, there are a lot of young Black women who are adopting the kind of systems that Stone Barns is doing, because it's the way that they can begin to feed people within their own communities. And this is another kind of transformation, I think, that we're going to see more in the future. And that is that, you know, now for almost a century, primarily we have seen rural people move into cities because that's where the jobs are. But now there's beginning to be financial difficulties of surviving within cities because of the kind of good paying jobs that are available are increasingly decreasing. And so there are now some young people and some of them young Black women who are recognizing that in their own communities, like, for example, my understanding is that inside the city of New York, there are roughly 25,000 acres that could be used to produce food. And so some of these young people begin to recognize that, and they begin to use some of those areas and grow food for people in their own communities. And they apparently are increasingly successful. And some of them are now featured by Stone Barns in some of the programs that they have. So, you know, again, I'm not predicting the future that all of this is going to happen, you know, in the next couple of years. But, you know, Jared Diamond reminded us that, you know, we are not very good as a human species in predicting the future, but we can anticipate changes and prepare for them in advance. And based on his lifetime of studies, what he discovered is that those individuals who anticipate changes and prepare them for them in advance are the ones that tend to be successful. Those that fail in that exercise are the ones that tended to, quote unquote, collapse. So I think that's, again, part of the culture that we need to cultivate, you know, in our own communities. Let's think together about some of the changes that are likely to happen. Not that we're predicting that they will happen, but they're likely to happen. And then how do we prepare for them in advance? And I think that's especially an important exercise, you know, for our children and grandchildren, because it's their future that's going to be at stake.
A great call to arms for all of us, too, to think differently about this and not get stuck in the day-to-day, but really think, you know, succession and planning for a more stable and just tomorrow. And fascinating about the urban agriculture. Yeah, you know, I think my mind always goes back to the idea of the Victory Gardens, World War II, and involvement, 50% of produce actually coming from people's backyard farms. You know, you have to wonder, and I don't know if there's been due diligence to deeply dive into what that influence is on the consumers that have to grow their own food. Because ultimately, when you become a producer yourself, you respect food and food values significantly more because you know how difficult it is and how much you have to stay with it and maintain that effort and that consistency with it to it reduces food waste because you know the time and effort put into it, and it reduces the idea of cheap food. So that's going to be a fascinating thing to watch as we keep going through these iterations of urban agriculture and what that does for generations next.
In that regard, there's another resource that I at least have found very inspiring. It's a new book just out by Beth Hoffman entitled Bet the Farm. And Beth Hoffman and her husband were successful in the journalism field out in California, but their family had some farmland here in Iowa. And Beth and her husband decided to come out here to Iowa and organize the farm in a way that we've just been describing. They are now, and again, my understanding of this, I haven't talked to them directly, but my understanding of this is that they are finding themselves relatively successful. And the reason they entitled it Bet the Farm is because they really were betting, you know, their whole future on becoming farmers here in Iowa. Bet the Farm has become enormously popular now in agriculture circles.
Huh. I'll take a look. I haven't read that one. That's a great book tip here. And you've mentioned a few between what David Montgomery put together with Growing Revolution, which I think is a classic, those 8 stories. We're talking about, you know, Beth Hoffman's new book here, Bet the Farm. And, you know, they're all these examples of solutions of change, or food solutions of change, and land management, land use adaptations, that it can be done. And, you know, I think any scenario where we're taking on big problems, it all happens between the ears. It has to be a change in these mindsets, these cultural awakenings and shift in mindsets. And I think that's to know these books and know where to turn to is a huge help. So thank you for that, Fred. You know, speaking of that, of shifting mindsets, I have one question related to regenerative, and it is kind of going mainstream. And there are claims that are, you know, easily doled out compared to actually living through the efforts and expense of actually taking action and behavioral change. You know, how do we prevent regenerative and the idea of soil health in our foods or as a climate action? How do we prevent that from being commandeered into just being marketing fluff or greenwashing from big food and big ag? And tied to that, if you can answer the second part of that, is how do we let the right ones in? Because we need big food, we need big ag to be involved in these equations, but how do we allow it, or how do we guarantee that it's not going to be for the wrong reasons, or again, just, you know, no authenticity, no integrity?
Yeah, another great question, and you know, part of my answer to that is going to be from the subtitle of Beth Hoffman's book, Bet the Farm. The subtitle is The Dollars and Cents of Growing Food in America. In other words, she recognized that the driver of success is going to be in the economic, and ultimately on the ground economics, and they're demonstrating that that in fact is working. And so again, I think that part of the revolution is going to take place. And again, the good news is that there, at least in my experience, there are a lot of young people who want to farm, but they don't want to do, you know, big monocultures. They want to grow food for people, and they want to build those relationships, you know, with their own bioregions. And so I think that as we begin to develop these cultures of the importance of what we need to do to be, you know, long-term successful, sustainably successful in our own bioregions, and how we eat and how we produce the food that we eat is an incredible part of that, I think then you're going to begin to see this kind of revolution take place. And to some extent, it's already taking place. I think the challenge is that it's not taking place fast enough to deal with some of the other challenges that we're going to be facing as a human society, and that is the challenge of climate change and all these other things that we're already beginning to experience and see. And so, from my point of view at least, how we eat and how we produce our food can become a critical part of the solution to the problems of climate change. And again, using E.O. Wilson's wisdom of keeping half of the earth in wildness, and we can grow a lot of food that we eat in our own bioregions and maintain some of the wildness in those communities. Ultimately, we're going to, of course, also have to deal with a concept that's not very popular, and that is the rate at which the human population has been growing on the planet. And we have to begin to recognize that we humans are not the masters and possessors. We are a part of the life in the community. And again, another resource that I found really useful in this is a book that was published a few years ago by Mary Evelyn Tucker and Brian Swim, entitled Journey of the Universe. And one of the things they point out is that if we humans still think that we're in control of planet Earth, we have to recognize that planet Earth is part of a much larger universe, and it is going to be determined by the evolution of that larger universe. And then that larger universe is part of a much larger cosmos, which has been evolving for 14 billion years. And the future of our universe is going to be dependent upon how that cosmos continues to evolve. And so we as humans on our little planet Earth have to begin paying attention to this larger evolution and learn how we adapt to that evolution and live in a way that we can thrive within that evolution. That's the part of how we have to think about our future. And I realize that those are major, major spiritual and culture shifts that we have to make in our own conscience, in our own communities, in our own societies. But I think it is possible. And again, Becker Farm is one example of somebody already beginning to do that on the ground.
Great stuff, Fred. That's quite a philosophical perspective. Yes, and we are just but specks of dust out there, no doubt. But I think that's really an interesting factoid, is that now, unlike any other time, we have that capacity to make vast change. We can be involved in these discussions. And so, that was stunning. I wanted to leave you to kind of drop the mic on that. When you get up and you get going, I've seen you so many times speak, I'm always so inspired, and I know our listening audience will as well. But I want to close on one last question. I'm trying to do it with this series here, which is an empowerment message, or really a call to action for listening. So bringing it full circle, what is the call to action for our listeners to be involved in this soil health revolution, in this land use adaptation? How can we be involved in this revolutionary change?
From my own perspective, I think that, first of all, there are things happening, even no matter which community you're living in, and in some communities, these new culture shifts that are beginning to happen, are more recognized or more prominent than they are in others. But there are people, I think, at least in my experience, there are people in almost every community that are at least beginning to consider this, especially when they think about the future of their children and their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. And, they want to make sure that they have, a future that's viable and hopefully, pleasant and thriving. And so once they begin to recognize, and we will all, I think, begin to recognize increasingly that our current system is just not functional anymore. This notion that we are somehow, as humans, in charge, that we somehow control things and that we're the masters and possessors, that's just not a viable option anymore. And so as we begin to recognize that and then begin to internalize the question of, you know, what can we do to prepare, you know, our children and our grandchildren for a better future, given these changes that we can now anticipate. And I think that that's probably, from my perspective, the most viable way to approach that.
Well, thank you so much, Fred. You know, every time I get a chance to catch up with you and hear you speak and engage, it's just so, you've been such an influence in my life, and I'm so glad I can share that with our listening audience as they also find these areas of interest, these threads to be involved in a food movement, a climate movement, and again, soil being such a foundational point of that. So thank you so much, Fred, for taking the time during the holiday season. I wish you and your family happy holidays.
Well, and you have a happy holiday as well. And I hope hopefully this conversation that we've shared with others will have some positive impact.